This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 143. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer. Improved Photography is just one of our shows. We have the Photo Taco Podcast, Thoughts on Photography Podcast, and the Portrait Session Podcast, all produced every single week. So check them out on iTunes. Just take a second if you're brand new to the show and subscribe to all our shows and at least give them a try. We've been getting really, really good reviews about all those new shows. But today we have a ton of listener questions to tackle here on Improved Photography. And to talk about through today's questions, we have Darren Meller and Nick Page. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, hey.
All right, so this is episode number 3 of all of these listener questions that people sent to us on the Improved Photography Podcast Facebook group. Now, on the Improved Photography Facebook page, just Improved Photography, we have over 500,000 photographers following Improved Photography that we post all kinds of things on there. But on the group, this is just, I think it's just over 1,000 of us in there right now. And this is just listeners of the podcast. This is the kind of the people that want to do photo talk all the time. Now, I will ask you one thing. If you join that group, and I would ask you to do it, we'll approve you as soon as we get you your request to join. Just search Improved Photography Podcast on Facebook. But when somebody posts something, click like on it. No matter what it is, just click like as you're browsing through. The reason is Facebook has a nasty habit of hiding posts if you aren't interacting with them. So if you're liking what you're seeing, click like for sure. If you don't like getting the posts about photography in your Facebook feed, you want to move on to horrible political stories and stuff, just unlike the group. Don't follow the group. But if you're going to be in the group, please do click like. It really helps us to be able to contact each other. Otherwise, Facebook starts hiding posts. All right, let's get to some of the questions for this week. And this one is going out to Papa Bear. this is Nick Page's girlfriend, Annalise, who submitted this question. And she says, this question is for Papa Bear, aka Nick Page. Actually, it's for Erica because she'll give me an answer. How do you get crisp, clean, and accurate colors in post? I'm constantly at war with my white balance and without a gray card. I've been using the Expo disc and it just looks muddy. What is the secret for beautiful colors? Help. Boy, your girlfriend should have listened to me, Nick. I told her about the Expo disc. Doesn't she listen to the podcast?
Yeah, and she makes fun of me right along with you guys.
She's great. I like her already. I haven't even met her yet, but I like her.
Suffice it to say that the Expo disc was a failed experiment, okay? I'm going to give that to you guys. I'm not going to give in very often, but the Expo disc was a failure, and I can vouch for her. She is always at war with her colors. Like, she has me come walk over her to her computer, like, you know, once a half hour to check her colors, and I coach her as much as I can, but her and I are both kind of constantly at war with our colors. So Jim, what's your secret? Because I know that you're not using gray cards and you're not using Expo discs. What do you do to get nice neutral colors?
Well, I don't know that I do anything too special, but I will say that a couple of common mistakes I see made with colors are, one, when you're shooting in low light, your white balance is going to be off 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. When you're shooting in low light, your white balance is always going to be off. And almost always going to be off. And so one thing that has really helped to train my eye for white balance specifically is, for a long time, like a year, I heard a tip years ago that when you get into Lightroom or Photoshop, just go crazy with the white balance slider. Slide it clear over to the left or clear over to the right as soon as you open the photo, and then force your eye to not even pay attention to where zero is on that slider, but just move it until it looks right to your eye. And when you do that for 6 months or a year of just that training of putting it where it looks right and not just where it is automatically from the camera, you'll be able to spot white balance problems immediately when you see them. White balance problems are something that are tough to spot until you've really trained your eye to it. The other thing that I see commonly it's a common mistake with color is not understanding what the vibrance and the saturation sliders are doing different. If you don't know what they're doing different, you're always going to get it wrong. And usually I find that people just kind of have a pet favorite between the two. And it's like, I'm using the saturation slider. Why are you using saturation instead of vibrance? Because that's what I always do, you know? Right. So find out what they really do. The saturation slider is going to impact yellows and oranges much more, and reds to a lesser extent, much more than the vibrant slider is going to. And we have articles on improved photography that go into more detail, but at least know that basic level of what they're doing. And then when you're making changes to color, you can do it smartly. Your eye can probably tell you, it can tell. You just have to throw it off first, and then your eye will know how to put it back together. But when you open the photo, it can be hard to know which way to slide it.
Very cool. And for me, like when I'm in doubt, I always err on the side of too warm. Because, you know, I'm doing so many portraits and stuff. A warm photo, at least they look healthy, you know. But if you err on the side of too cool, they just look lifeless and dead. So, exactly. So if you're going to...
You got Smurfs walking around.
Exactly. So it's always better to err on the side of warm if you're not super sure. So that's what I've been doing.
All right. Greg cool. Murr is a volunteer fire department photographer, air photographer, and he shoots mostly incidents where it's low light on his 5D Mark III. He uses fast glass. He's shooting in aperture priority mode, wide open with auto ISO. He's looking for advice on how you would approach shooting at night on an accident or fire scene and where the lighting is changing constantly from flashing lights.
Advice number one, save the people first.
Yes.
Seriously.
Yeah. So this is a perfect plug for me to talk about shooting in manual, because anytime that you have all those flashing lights and you know, super dark areas with this super bright fire, your meter is going to be so confused by all that. And if you shoot in manual, you get your exposure right once, and it's pretty much going to work for you unless things change drastically. So shooting in manual would be my number one tip for this. And also, like in those kind of situations, a lot of times it's really difficult to achieve focus for your camera to actually be able to focus. So a quick tip is to put your focus point whichever focus point you're using, put that right on the edge of where the fire meets the dark, or where there's an extreme point of contrast, whether it's like the edge of the fire truck where, you know, there's a little bit of light bouncing off the edge of it. You know, find a point of focus and put your focus point on that, and that'll help you achieve focus in those super dark situations.
That's a great tip, to shoot in manual. And I can see how that could be tricky, because whenever I see quickly changing light situations, I think, I want to shoot in aperture priority mode to take advantage of the exposure meter so they can get it right. But the problem is this: when, you know, it's nighttime, a lot of the photo is going to be black, period. It just will be. And so let's say I'm taking a picture of not a house, a barn is burning, right? Well, if I zoom way out, there's going to be a lot of black around the barn, right? And that's going to completely change the exposure from when I zoom in and get rid of all the black on the sides and just focus on the burning house, right? But actually the exposure is the same, because we want the black to stay black. We don't need to expose that. That's why you'd want to shoot in manual mode rather than shutter or aperture priority. So I think that's a great tip.
Cool.
Nick Lynn asks, are there any specific rules on when and where not to shoot with your camera angled? Do you still use the rule of thirds, and should you take a safe shot first and then rotate for a creative angle? So this, she's talking about when you're kind of shooting scattywampus. My wife loves scattywampus. She likes everything scattywampus. Like when she's decorating a room in the house, it's like first thing she always goes to is put the couch in the corner, right? She all likes everything angled. So when you're doing photography, this is a, you know, personal taste thing. A lot of people want to just tilt the frame kind of at an angle, just kind of creatively, just kind of adds, it makes the photo look kind of dynamic and interesting. I'd say it's rare that I like a shot that does this. Sometimes you'll get a portrait where you're trying to make it look real creative and dynamic, a senior portrait or something from a low down angle. And it can be cool sometimes. I don't know if there's like a rule of thumb when to do this, but it's just something you can try every once in a while. But if you have more than one shot in your portfolio with a creatively tilted axis, it's probably too much.
Right.
This can really, really get overdone. Once you take one cool shot with this, it can be tempting to do this a lot.
I feel like it's almost like the selective color thing. Like it's a crutch that people fall on. Like, well, it's a kind of a good shot, so I'll just put this angle on it and it turns into a great shot. No, that's generally not how it works. Like, I can tell you some examples of when definitely not to do it. If you have very definite horizon lines or very definite lines that you know are supposed to be parallel to the ground or vertical, don't do it because it's just so obvious and it just makes the OCD people in the world like myself just like go crazy looking at the photo, wanting to grab it and rotate it, because if you have a horizon line, it needs to be parallel to the bottom of the frame. It just does.
Yeah, very good point. And the next question comes from Pat Lopez, who says, how much will print image quality suffer if I choose a low megapixel camera and simply upsize the image for large prints? Okay, this is actually great timing. On October 1st, tomorrow, I am publishing an article on improvephotography.com that answers exactly this question. Now, it's something interesting that I found. So I used to shoot a 36 megapixel full frame Nikon, and I switched to the Fuji X-T1, which is only 16 megapixels. The interesting thing about it is if you actually run the numbers, there is hardly any difference between 12 megapixels and 24 megapixels when we're talking about how big of a print you can make. Now, let me explain why that is. When you have a, let's say we have a print that's, you know, just the size of your thumb, right? It's like 1 inch by 1 inch, right? Well, anything can fill that. Now, for every inch or every centimeter we add outside, for every centimeter in length we add, we're not just doubling the size. Sometimes we're tripling the size that we need to add, right? It's like a TV. The difference between a 55-inch TV and a 70-inch TV, well, 70 isn't double 55, but the actual screen area is doubled, going from 55 to 70, right? So the reason that I make that point about area, right, it's happening a little bit exponentially. As you add 1 inch or 1 centimeter in the length, it's making a huge amount of print that we need to fill. So the reason I start with that is 16 by 20 is a breaking point for a lot of cameras. Mm-hmm. You can print at 300 DPI. That's like perfect image quality. Yes, there are printers that can get higher than that, but I mean, we're talking about a scientific difference. If you're at 300 DPI, you are gonna have a perfect looking print. No problem with resolution, right? Never gonna be a problem. At 16 by 20, almost all the cameras drop out. You know, you can print an 11 by 14, but going up to the 16 by 20, anything under 24 megapixels can't do it anymore at 300 DPI. And so you're like, oh, I'm going to have to shoot this A7R II to be able to fill a photo, to really get perfect resolution on a picture. And it's not true, because you don't have to be printing at 300 DPI for your print to look good. Somehow as photographers, we've decided that's the gold standard, but you have an impressive eye if you can tell the difference between 240 DPI and 300 DPI. Mm-hmm. So DPI is the dots per inch, how many dots of ink we're getting in 1 square inch of the photo. And so basically, read the article that's up there, just right on the homepage of Improved Photography. You'll see the article on how big can you print. But the real answer is, as basically any camera you're shooting can print a billboard, it's going to do just fine. Because what we've been talking about is the theoretical perfect image quality, but really, as the print gets bigger, you step back. Your viewing distance to the photo decreases or increases. You aren't going to put your nose right up to a billboard. You're going to see it from a long ways away. So in reality, if you have 16 megapixels, just go ahead and print whatever you feel like. It's not going to be a problem. So that's the short answer, but read the article.
And I think this is really relevant right now because, you know, Sony is coming out with these A7S cameras that have amazing low light capabilities, but they're fairly low megapixel in order to get that. And I guess what I would say to that is that, you know, people were printing pretty large images not too long ago off of like 8 megapixel, you know, one, whatever those cameras were, you know, 5-6 years ago, right. They were 8 megapixels and they were printing large then. So I think that even these A7S cameras that are 12 megapixels or whatever they are, they're going to be able to print pretty large, I would think.
Totally agree.
All right. Brian Pex asks about using multiple speed lights. He's using 2 or 3 speed lights and he wants to know what is the equivalent of shooting 1-to-1. He's trying to cut down on the recycle time for a project that he's using.
All right. The convenient thing about flash photography, Brian, is this totally answers the question for you with like second grade math. So when your flash power says 1/2 or half, it means it's half the power of one. So if you have one flash at 1/1 full power, when you have 2 flashes, it's going to be put them at half. And now you have the equivalent of 1 full flash. It really is just that simple as the fraction. It makes it very simple when you're using multiple flashes to know what that's going to be. I use this all the time. The reason that you would use multiple flashes instead of just one is the recycle time. The battery can't go fast enough to go pop, 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 pop as fast as you can click a picture. It's going to go pop, pop when we're shooting the full amount of flash. So since we don't want to wait around for the flash all day, you just put 2 speed lights in there and then you can go pop, 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 pop. And it can go much, much quicker. So simple to figure out the fractions when you're doing that. Shouldn't be any problem at all. Awesome. Robert Laura says, I can imagine what side most of you fall on, but are there any supporters for mostly shooting in JPEG? I use a Chromebook, so RAW doesn't really play well. Okay, so a Chromebook is basically a computer with, well, I mean, of course it has an operating system, but it's no operating system, basically. Basically, it's just a pipe to the internet. And so it doesn't play well with photographers. Chromebooks are a horrible option if you're a serious photographer, because as photographers, well, we need to take our photos and put them on the computer and use programs like Lightroom that don't exist on the web. So a Chromebook is really a bad option for a photographer. Great option otherwise, you know, if you got a college student or something, but as a photographer, it's a terrible option. Now, about JPEGs in general, the difference that we all imagine there being between a JPEG and RAW is almost always overblown. In fact, if you take a you know, fine quality, high resolution JPEG and you put it next to a RAW file, there is not a lot of difference in how much detail you can pull out. You can pull out a ton of detail from a JPEG. And every time I hear somebody saying it's a huge difference in what you can do in RAW, I always think, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a difference. I definitely don't shoot in JPEG. I shoot in RAW always. But at the same time, I think, have you ever actually tested it side by side? Because it's not that big of a difference, honestly. So don't feel like you're limited. You're going to do just fine with shooting in JPEG. If that's all you can do, do that.
Yeah, the biggest place you're going to notice it is when, if you shoot your initial image with the wrong white balance, because when you go to try to change the white balance on a JPEG, it just doesn't work very well. You can only do so much. Oh, well, let's have an argument then, because it's true.
No, I totally disagree. There's going to be zero difference. Practical difference is what I should say. So when you shoot a photo in RAW, and if you had the white balance off, you can change it after the fact and it's going to make no difference. It's just as good as if you had made the change in camera. Now, the only reason it affects the JPEG really in a practical sense is that you're having to save the image twice. And every time you save, JPEG is going to lose some data. But when we're talking about a fine quality JPEG, one time Dustin and I, Dusty O, I talked to him earlier today, by the way. Oh, wow. But I talked to Dusty O and I had this debate once and I said, okay, let's take a JPEG, open it up, you know, make no change to it, save it and save it and save it and save it and save it. You know, so you're making copies over of copies of copies of copies. We did this 30 times and the image quality was still very, very, very good. So I disagree. This is really not going to make any practical difference in doing it.
I disagree.
We can disagree. That's all right.
All right. John Evans asks, what is the best way to approach real estate photography agents or actual agencies to offer your services as a photographer for their listings? I'm interested to see how you two have done it because I would like to get into this niche.
I think that just going in person and actually introducing yourself is a good way of doing it. Go in with some business cards and hopefully a link to some examples of your work, or even bring in like some physical prints of your work. Most of those type of shoots that you get, it's not necessarily based on your work. It's based on your likability and, you know, how much you get along with the people. So just going in person, being personable and giving them a business card, I think that's really one of the best ways you can, you know, interact with new potential clients.
Very good. Win Fam says, is it time to upgrade my Nikon D7000? It's 5-year-old tech, and I'm wondering if image quality has improved that much. The Nikon D7000 is a camera dear to my heart. That was the camera that I owned when I started to improve photography more than 5 years ago. That is a great camera. Are you going to see a difference if you were to upgrade today? Oh yeah, you definitely will. Really in the low light performance and resolution categories, everything else is going to be pretty much the same. You're going to see more autofocus points, higher resolution, better low light performance, and better connectivity. You know, you'll have Wi-Fi and things like that. That's about what we've done in the last 5 years. You know, assuming you're sticking with a, you know, the same kind of level of Nikon camera, that's about what you're going to get. It's a really nice upgrade. Is it like you can't be a good photographer if you don't switch? Nah, you're going to be able to take great pictures with that. I still have maybe one or two pictures in my portfolio that I took with the Nikon D7000. It's a great camera. So don't feel limited, but yeah, you'll get some nice upgrades. James Williams asks, what would you recommend as a first light modifier? What do you think, Nick?
This one's easy. Shoot through umbrella. That should be everybody's first one. It's easy to use. It's versatile. And it's like the most flattering light you can get out of a modifier. So yeah, shoot through umbrella.
Now, I know you use some huge white shoot through umbrellas. What kind of size would you recommend?
You know, I think 43 inches is probably the most versatile. Anything smaller than that, it's going to be too hard of a light. Anything larger than that, and it just starts getting cumbersome. I have a 60-inch umbrella. I have a 7-foot umbrella that, like, I've used twice. but the 43-inch ones are just so, they're versatile, and they're about the right size. So I would just go straight for the 43-inch one.
Good advice. And that's about a meter for our international listeners.
Yeah.
Pete LeGregor says, this might be a whole podcast, but I would be interested in a discussion about sharpening. Should we use Lightroom or Photoshop for our sharpening? And do you sharpen all of your files only on output or when you come in? So, you know, this is totally a personal preference thing. So I want to go round robin on this one and see what you guys do. I'm mostly interested in, well, and I'm interested in what both of you guys do on this one. But for me, I don't so much worry about sharpening when a photo is going on the web. The difference is really small because rarely do we see a big, nice, beautiful full screen photo on the web. And when we're talking tiny, you have to be careful not to over sharpen a photo, because the smaller the photo is, the weirder it's going to look when you over sharpen it. Mm-hmm. So I'm always kind of careful about over sharpening if the photo is going to go on the web, to the point that I rarely even touch the sharpening when I'm just exporting a normal photo to the web. When I print, I definitely sharpen, and I spend a good amount of time making sure the sharpening is just right for the medium that I'm going to and things like that. I do my sharpening for prints in Photoshop because I want to size it to the right size on a canvas and get it all ready there and use the more advanced sharpening. And everything else I would just do In Lightroom. But if you haven't played with this enough to see what an oversharpened image looks like, all you have to do is watch Good Morning America if you're in the United States. They so oversharpen that video. Like, seriously, just set your DVR to record Good Morning America. It's way oversharpened. It's such a professional production. I don't know why they do that or why nobody has noticed there, but way oversharpened. Perfect example of it. All right, Darren, what do you do with sharpening?
I just go through the modules inside Lightroom and work my way down to sharpening. I do it last within an image, and I never mess with output sharpening, but I always make sure to zoom in, zoom out as I adjust that sharpening slider and make sure that I'm also, if I have a shallow depth of field within the shot, that I'm using the masking slider so it's not trying to sharpen my bokeh.
So Lightroom applies a tiny bit automatically. Are you doing more than that usually?
Yeah, Lightroom usually defaults to about 25 in my experience. So I will push it sometimes to maybe plus 40, and then my radius I'll push to maybe plus 1.4 at the max. But if I start to zoom in and zoom out and I notice that the picture looks kind of crunchy, then what I'll do is just back the sharpening off. It's kind of like saturation. If it looks like too much, I'll just throttle it back a hair and it's usually about fine.
Good, Nick.
I pretty much do all my sharpening in Lightroom. Even when I'm like doing a lot of stuff in Photoshop, I prefer to just do it in Lightroom. And the reason for that is, like Darren, I like to mask some of it out. And I actually reduce the radius just so it's a more fine grain kind of thing. If your radius gets a little bit, that number gets a little too high, it looks crunchy in my opinion. And then most of the sharpening I like to do is actually locally with just an adjustment brush. So if I've got a particular texture or area of the photo that I really want to pop, I'll just paint in a little bit of sharpening into those parts of the image. Don't really play with too much on the output sharpening, but I sharpen pretty much every photo, but because I think in my head that I'm going to print every photo whether I do or not. So I kind of prepare it, each one, like I'm going to print it.
Very good.
All right. Zvika Steen asks whether we could talk about lens corrections in Lightroom and why we do not use it in the 2015 presets.
All right. So he's talking about the Lightroom Steel. That's our preset package that we release with all the latest styles and trends every Black Friday on improvephotography.com. It's our big thing. Everybody in the community gets it. And we get just crazy amounts of positive feedback with the Lightroom presets. I already have half of the Lightroom presets done for this year. I just work on them all throughout the year to get them really dialed in. So in last year's presets deal, he noticed that I don't use the lens correction hardly ever in Lightroom. Here's the reason I don't use the lens correction very often. Sometimes I do. Think about what Lightroom has to do. You get a photo and it's warped, right? You know, it's distorted from the lens, making the center a little bit too bloated and the sides a little bit too smashed in. Every lens distorts to some extent, but wide angle lenses especially distort a lot. And so you can click this button in Lightroom and whoop, everything looks fairly normalish. The reason that I don't use it very often is, how is it going vroop, right? That's the question. Where's the vloop coming in from? And to do that, it has to stretch the pixels. That's the only way that it can do it. It can't just, it has to invent what was there to make everything look right. It's stretching pixels. And whenever you stretch pixels, you're losing detail, you're losing sharpness, and you're usually losing contrast. Now, it's usually well controlled, but sometimes this can happen in a spot on the photo where it's really not good. Like if somebody's face was in a spot that had some distortion and now we're stretching it, it's going to look terrible, right? So there are definitely negatives to lens correction. Now, I'm not saying you should never use it. I use it fairly regularly, but it's the kind of thing that doesn't really belong in most presets, in my opinion, because it really depends on what specific lens you used and what specifically it looks like. If something that you have to protect is in an area of the photo that's going to get stretched, then you would not want to do it. So since it doesn't apply globally to most photos, I don't see it as being something you'd want in presets.
Yeah, it's really a case by case kind of kind of situation. The only preset that I have that I use that in is my real estate preset, because real estate is
a perfect example.
Right. That's one of the times where you want all your lines to be straight. I don't really care about the sharpness. I just want straight lines. And that's one of the ways you get it.
Perfect example. Eddie Hagler said, do professional photographers really use autofocus? Yes.
Yes, always.
I think we can speak for all of us.
Yes.
I like almost 100% of my photos use autofocus. Now, just to be clear, for the, you know, if we have maybe more beginning photographers listening, autofocus means that you press halfway down on the shutter button or on the back button, however you have it set up, and it goes to go where you want it to be. It does not mean haphazard focus, which is what I consider where you have the camera choosing which autofocus point to focus on. That's just haphazard. It never gets it right, ever. So every professional photographer I know is moving the focus point over to where we want it sharp, but then using the camera's autofocus to actually turn the lens to get it to the right spot. So
I would say the only professional photographers that don't use autofocus are professional landscape photographers or astrophotographers.
Or don't always,
Right, exactly. And you know, a lot of pros that are shooting landscapes, a lot of times they are using live view and zooming in and manually focusing the lens. So that would be the only caveat to that.
Or using contrast focus, which is a little slower, but works great for landscapes.
Right, but that's still auto. Yeah, good. Steve Love says, I've been listening for a while, but I'm new to this Facebook group. Here's my question. How much editing or compositing is too much editing or compositing? My answer to that would be as soon as the photo doesn't fit what you're trying to say. If you're a news photographer, well, two clicks is too much editing, you know? And, you know, news photographers can make some edits. They can certainly touch the contrast or the color in ways that don't change the nature of the scene, but the point that I'm trying to make, they can't edit very much. For me, I don't shoot news. What I do is I make pretty pictures of pretty things. And so how much editing is too much? Well, as soon as it stops looking good for me, it's really just depends on how you want to photograph what you're shooting. There isn't really a necessarily right or wrong answer. There are certainly times that it's just too much and it looks ugly, but your personal taste really plays a lot into that. For example, one of the photos of mine that's been probably one of the most popular pictures I've taken, at least, was of the Olympic gold medalist in swimming, Bria Larson, diving into the pool. I spent well over 3 hours in Photoshop just on that one photo. Wow. In fact, it was probably closer to 6 hours in Photoshop on that one photo to dial in exactly right. But most of my pictures, you know, are maybe 15 to 20 minutes, the ones that go on my portfolio, at least, you know, just family pictures, it's going to be 15 seconds or so, but everybody's different. Nick and Darren, I know both of you guys don't usually spend a lot of time in Photoshop and Lightroom. Is that right?
Some of my landscape shots, I spend maybe 15 minutes tops. Any longer than that, and I start, you know, tapping my toe and getting really bored because I've got a slight case of ADD and I want to move on to the next thing. You know, as my skills in Photoshop get better, I have to ask myself, just because I can do something, do I really want to do it? Because you're either going to be one of those photographers where it's like, gloves are off, anything goes, you know, I'm going to put this mountain in this shot. Yeah. Or you can be one of those that's like, I want people to actually believe that what I took a picture of actually existed. If you go too far down the editing road, people aren't going to believe what you're posting anymore. And part of me is like, well, you know, if I replace this sky, people are going to not believe it. And like, so I'm at that crossroads right now where I'm afraid of over editing because I don't want my audience to not believe what I'm sharing.
And I share that fear as well. I treat Photoshop like Walmart. I'm in and out as fast as possible.
Especially when you're making the milk run at midnight and it's like, please don't get stabbed. Please don't get stabbed.
You got that right.
I don't know. It's an interesting discussion because, you know, like for me, I don't really care if people believe that it's real. In fact, I'll just tell you it's not real. I'm. It's not like I'm trying to trick anybody into thinking it's real. My object in making a photo is to just produce something that's beautiful, that's going to evoke a reaction of beauty. That's what I'm shooting for when I shoot. And so I don't want people to think that because it's not true. I'm not trying to make anything that's real. I approach photography much as a painter approaches a canvas. They aren't, you know, going to the canvas and saying, okay, I've got to make this coconut tree look exactly like the coconut tree actually did. I've got to make the sunset look exactly like the sunset actually did. Most painters are not doing that. In fact, very few would do that because they're artists. They're trying to create something interesting. They're trying to exercise their creativity. And to me, that's where I get the best outlet of creativity is when I can just go crazy to what seems interesting and fun to me.
Yeah.
Well, that does it for our questions for this week. It took a 3-part episode to get through all the questions. Thanks everybody for submitting them. But we always share a doodad of the week, something cool, interesting that we have found. Sometimes it can be a resource or a product that we want to share. And this week, let's throw it to Darren first. What's your doodad this week?
Mine is wool socks. I made my annual trip out to Colorado for the fall color, and I was standing by this really shallow lake where the Maroon Bells are near Aspen, and I decided to march into the lake, and I didn't have waterproof boots or anything, but I got some really, really cool shots and my feet stayed warm. So wool is one of the few fabrics out there that stays warm when it is completely drenched, and it enables you to get completely soaked without getting hypothermia.
Nice.
Good tip.
Mine is going to be a road atlas. When I'm going on my big long road trips,
You mean like a map?
Yes, like a
paper
physical
map?
Made out of dead trees map. Yes. I like to
Did you get it from a pirate? Is there an X on it anywhere?
There is. Yarr. There is. So I'm getting ready for the Utah trip. So I got my Utah and Arizona atlases coming in the mail. And I like to get the great big red books that, you know, have like all the detail and have a page per, you know, section of the state. So road atlases are super useful because when you're out on these long adventures, you don't always have cell service. And if any of you have made the mistake of, like, you know, highlighting certain areas that you want to go and putting it into Google Maps or Google Earth or something, then you get close to it and you have no service and you can't access that information or the maps. What I like to do is before I leave on my road trip, I sit down at Google Earth. I sit down with my atlas, and in my atlas, I circle the places I want to go. That way, when I'm on my road trip, I always have directions with me in case I don't have service. So atlases for road trips.
Very cool. Well, today I want to point you to a resource on improved photography. Many of the listeners of Improved Photography submitted images to me for an ISO invariance test. Thank you guys to everybody who submitted those. Made a really nice resource. So what ISO invariance is means that you can take a picture at high ISO and get the image properly exposed. Let's say it's a night photo. And then what if you keep your aperture and your shutter the exact same, but now you drop your ISO to, you know, base ISO 100, right? Well, the image is going to be extremely dark, right? Because everything was the same except the ISO that was high to properly expose it. And now we've changed it back down to 100. So it's going to make a dark image. So what ISO invariance is, it says it's a new technology in some image sensors that allows you to take that black image in Photoshop or Lightroom and just crank the exposure slider. And when you do, you'll get the exact same image as if you had used just the high ISO, at least the same noise profile. This is a really exciting technology in some cameras, and we tested about 20 different popular cameras from Canon, Nikon, Sony, Pentax, Olympus, Fuji, and so go to improvephotography.com and just in the search, heck, just Google it. Just Google ISO invariance, and I bet we're the top result for it. ISO invariance, and then you can just look up your camera right there and see if your camera is ISO invariant or not. So check out the article. It's really an exciting technology, and in the article I highlight quite a few use cases that show you kind of why you would want to do this. We should talk about this more in an upcoming podcast, but it happened this week in the community, so I've got to mention it if you haven't checked it out yet. So Google ISO invariance and you'll see our article. Well, that does it this week for the Improved Photography Podcast. Thank you guys for sitting here and chatting with me, Nick and Darren. Always good to talk and argue with both of you guys about camera technology. And everybody, thank you for joining us. We'll see you in another 7 days. Bye.